Welcome to Conversations in World History. Today I'm speaking with Adam Hochschild. Adam is a journalist who writes history books as well. He's written some of my favorites, including King Leopold's Ghost, about slavery in the Belgian Congo, as well as the book Bury the Chains, Prophets and Rebels in the Fight to Free an Empire's Slaves, which we will discuss today. This book won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Penn USA Literary Award, and was a finalist for the National Book Award. He's recently come out with his 11th book, American Midnight, The Great War of Violent Peace and Democracy's Forgotten Crisis, about World War I on the home front in America. Adam is a lecturer at the University of California at Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, and it was just great to speak with him today about such a fantastic topic in world history. Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
So I have an important first big question, which is how to pronounce your last name.
Hochschild. Think Hoch as in spoke, Schild as in build, in building.
Okay. Well, there we go. That's it for the podcast. I'm done. That's what I needed to know. Adam, you've written a number of books. Which are the most widely known that people may have come across, and which are you most proud of?
King Leopold's Ghost has had by far the most readers. There are more than 500,000 copies in print in this country, and it's been translated into 15 languages. Next after that is the book that is my favorite of the history books I've done, To End All Wars, which is a book about the First World War and the opposition to it. That has more than 100,000 copies in print in this country and more in others, and is the book that I'm sort of most proud of.
Okay. Well, I will have to check that out. You also wrote, I think I read a book about the Spanish Civil War. Is that correct?
I did. Spain in Our Hearts, about the Americans involved in the Spanish Civil War.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk mostly about Bury the Chains, which is about the British anti-slavery movement. And I love that book. I've used it in my class year after year. It's really a remarkable story. And it focuses on the British anti-slavery movement. So why is this story important? Because I think a lot of people don't know it.
Yeah. To me, it's important because it was, in some sense, the first modern human rights movement. And that it was the first time that a large number of people in one country, hundreds of thousands of people, got outraged over the plight of other people of another color in another part of the world. There was a kind of a international cross-racial thinking and feeling there that the world had not really seen before. And that's partly what I found so exciting about the movie.
So how did you come across and get interested in this story?
Often you come into things indirectly. And I am always interested in people who change sides. And I had read something about John Newton, a famous hymn writer who wrote Amazing Grace and all sorts of other hymns, which we still sing today. And I was fascinated that he had begun his life as a slave ship captain, in fact, made 4 transatlantic slaving voyages, and another one, you know, just down the coast of Africa. And I thought, wow, this is going to be an interesting biography to write, a sort of story of personal transformation. But the more I looked into it, the more I found that his life didn't fit the script, that John Newton had had his conversion to evangelical Christianity before he entered the slave trade. And that was interesting to think about. And moreover, after he left the slave trade, not out of moral principles, but for medical reasons, settled in England, became the most famous evangelical preacher of his day, the most famous hymn writer, wrote all those beautiful hymns. And for 30 years, he never said a word about slavery until one day a young man named Thomas Clarkson came to see him representing an activist committee organizing this issue and said, Reverend Newton, you really should speak out about this. And then he finally wrote a pamphlet, testified before Parliament, and then never said another word on the subject for the rest of his life. So I thought, well, who was this fellow Clarkson? And maybe that was the story.
Some people might be familiar with this story also from the movie Amazing Grace, which is really about the British anti-slavery movement, although it focuses almost solely on William Wilberforce. What's the basic time period that we're talking about here?
Okay, the movie, incidentally, I think wildly distorts history as in ways that you're probably aware of if you've read Bury the Chains. But nonetheless, it has great visuals and good actors. The time frame, interesting thing about that is that this movement against slavery in the British Empire began with startling suddenness, really in the year 1787. And why do I say startling suddenness? There were no opinion polls in those days, so you can't point to a moment where suddenly British opinion on this subject changed. But there was a pretty good gauge of public opinion, which is that one of the big public spectator sports in London was attending public debates. And there were debating societies all over the city where the proprietor charged sixpence to come in and see people debate on a topic of public interest. And it could be something frivolous, such as should women be allowed to wear big hats in the theater? It could be political issues of the day. And there were dozens of these places. And for years, they had very seldom, you know, was the subject of slavery debated there. Suddenly, the month of February, 1788, people have tabulated this. Half the debates in London were about the morality of slavery or the slave trade. So the movement was really born at that moment. And it had been prepared starting the previous year by Clarkson, the sort of activist organizer at the center of this movement, pulling together a committee of people who vowed to end first the slave trade and then slavery itself in the British Empire.
So Thomas Clarkson plays a really major role in this story. If you had to choose kind of four or five figures, people that everybody should know but probably don't know who are involved in this story, kind of your all-star team of the British abolition movement, who might be in that besides Clarkson?
Well, Clarkson certainly would be the central figure, as he is in my book. And perhaps I should just tell his story a little bit. He was a divinity student at Cambridge University, 25 years old, in 1785. And one of the big prizes to win at Cambridge was the annual Latin essay contest. And if you wrote the best Latin essay and won the contest, it was an honor that stuck with you for the rest of your life, like winning the Heisman Trophy in college football or being a Rhodes Scholar.
I haven't done any of those, so I don't know, but they all sound great.
Yeah. So he entered this contest with no ambition other than just to win the prize. But the contest essays, the topic for the essay that year, was about slavery. Is it ethical to make slaves of other people against their will? He got deep into the research. He was sort of a natural investigative reporter. He and his brother, who helped him with this, discovered that a family friend who'd been in the shipping business had ships that carried slaves as traffic. They got access to the records of this firm, and Clarkson was horrified at what he learned about slavery. He writes very movingly in his memoirs about how he stayed up, he left a candle burning in his room all night long, in case in the middle of the night a thought would occur to him, which would be useful in this essay, and he could write it down. He won the prize, He then set off for London to make his way in the world on the horse that he owned. And halfway there, and he writes about this so movingly, he said he got off his horse, he sat down by the side of the road, and said, a thought came to me that somebody should do something about this. And he devoted the remaining 61 years of his life to trying to end slavery, first in the British Empire and then in the rest of the world. And a spot where he got off the horse.
You found that?
Yeah, there's a little plaque there.
It sounds kind of like Paul falling off his horse.
Yes, on the road to Damascus.
Yeah.
There's a little plaque there. Unfortunately, the spot where he got off his horse is not a picturesque country pass, but the side of a four-lane highway. And but my wife and I found it, and a guy was working on a telephone pole next to the road and sort of came down to ask what was this American couple doing there, sort of prowling around his telephone pole. And we explained, and happily he knew about Clarkson.
Yeah.
Daughter had read about him at school, must have had a good school teacher like you. So anyway, so he's certainly one of the people in my all-star team that I tried to talk about in this book. Another is his chief collaborator, William Wilberforce, who was a member of Parliament. Clarkson was sort of the outside man who organized the effort outside of Parliament, pushing to get the law changed. Wilberforce was the inside man who, as a member of Parliament, made ending the slave trade and then slavery itself his prime cause, and agitated and spoke about this year after year after year after year. And it was really one of history's great partnerships. There were others who worked with them. In some ways, the most interesting person there is a man named James Stephen, who was a young London dandy and lawyer who got himself into a heap of trouble. He was engaged to marry one woman. He'd gotten another woman pregnant. He was having an affair with a third. And to sort of flee all these troubles, he did what many young British men trying to make their fortunes do. He left for the West Indies. The first place where his ship stopped was Barbados. And a friend of a friend there said, you really ought to come see a trial that's going on right now. It's the most interesting thing on the island. And it was a trial of four slaves who were accused of murder. And everybody, the white people on Barbados, sort of knew that this was a sham and that they were being made scapegoats for a white guy who'd actually committed the murder. Stephen went to the trial and was absolutely appalled to find that the slaves had been found guilty and been sentenced to execution by being burned alive, which was the standard punishment there. And that shock changed his life. He remained in the West Indies for more years, gathered a lot of information about how the system worked, how plantations worked, went back to England, entered Parliament, became an associate of Wilberforce, and came up with the parliamentary strategy that 20 years later, 1807, got the ban on the British slave trade through Parliament. The abolitionists hoped that would end slavery itself, but it didn't, and then they had to go to bat again years later to end slavery itself.
So what years are we talking about? The end of the slave trade and then the end of slavery itself?
The British slave trade ended in 1807, and the abolitionists sort of assumed that if there wasn't this constant resupply from slaves from Africa, that slavery would die out in the West Indies. And when we're talking about British slavery, we're talking about the West Indian Islands, enormously lucrative sugar plantations primarily. But also coffee and indigo and tobacco and some other things. But then, of course, once the supply of new slaves from Africa shriveled up, the planters realized that to preserve and expand their human property, they had to treat the slaves a little better, provide medical care, allow them to, you know, reproduce, as had been happening already in the United States, where the slave program, the slave population was growing quite rapidly without the import of large numbers of slaves. So the slave population in the British West Indies started to grow, and then finally the movement came back to life in a big way. And in 1833, they got Parliament to finally end British slavery itself, which took effect in 1833.
And one of the people who comes into your story in the later dates, and I found really interesting, was Elizabeth Hayrick, who takes a different position than some of the earlier heads of the abolition movement. What role does she play in kind of pushing the story to its culmination?
She came to prominence in the 1820s. She was a very livewire, fiery woman, a convert to the Quaker faith. And this was a time, by the way, when it was unthinkable that women and men would be working together in the same political cause. So the anti-slavery societies that had existed up to this point were all men. She started a whole string of women's anti-slavery societies, some 70 of them, and they took a more radical position than the men, pushing for immediate abolition, whereas a lot of the male-dominated societies felt, well, the best way to get this thing through Parliament is to do it in stages. And Elizabeth Hayrick had the very understandable position that, you know, if this is evil, it ought to be ended now.
Mm. And maybe we round out that all-star team with Olodow Equiano, who...
Yes, definitely. Olodow Equiano was an African who, by his own description, had been born in what today is Nigeria and then transported as a teenager to the West Indies on a slave ship. And there he worked on various of the islands. Then he had a job on a ship that traveled between the West Indian islands trading. And by trading himself on the side, buying, you know, some good, whether it was pottery or iron implements or something on one island that he could sell at a higher price on another island, he accumulated enough money to buy his own freedom. In other words, to buy himself from his owner. Then he made his way to England. He became friends with Thomas Clarkson and some of the other abolitionists there. And he wrote his autobiography, which is sort of the first full autobiography of a former slave that we have. It became a bestseller. And just as this abolitionist movement was getting underway in the late 1780s, early 1790s, Equiano set off on a five-year book tour to promote his book all over England, Scotland, Ireland. He was received with particular warmth in Ireland because the Irish felt they'd been pushed around by the British also.
Mm. So, okay, so to pull a little bit of this together, so 1787, this movement really bursts onto the scene. You have a number of people who get really involved. In 1807, they managed to end the slave trade. 1833, they end slavery itself. Now, all the British had been obviously really involved in the slave trade for hundreds of years. They had colonies like Jamaica, which had a huge amount of sugar-based slavery, plantation slavery. There were also revolts and rebellions going on in the Caribbean itself, and obviously the Haitian Revolution, but revolts of slaves in Jamaica and Barbados and other places. What were some of the strategies that the anti-slavery movement used to try to influence Parliament and change public opinion?
You're right to mention those slave revolts in the West Indies, because that was a huge part of it. By the end, it's no coincidence that the final vote in Parliament to end slavery came in 1833, because just a year and a half previously, the largest slave revolt ever to take place in British territory had happened in Jamaica. It took the British Army some 6 weeks to suppress it, and, you know, both civilian and military officials came back to Britain, testified before Parliament that next time we're going to have more trouble doing this. So that was a powerful push. On the domestic organizing front in Britain itself, the remarkable and to me tremendously exciting thing about this movement is that they pioneered everything that we think of as being part of political organizing today. First of all, the very idea of, you know, a movement agitating for a cause with headquarters in the national capital and corresponding committees and branches in smaller cities and towns all over the country, that was something pretty new. Something that was totally unheard of previously, which again we don't think about today, is the idea of people of different religious faiths coming together to agitate for a secular end. You know, Britain was very much divided. Everybody was either an Anglican, Quaker, or a Methodist, or a Baptist, and it made a great deal of difference what faith you belonged to, because, of course, only Anglicans, you know, had full citizenship and could enter Parliament and enter the army and enter the legal profession.
And Quakers play a really prominent role in this struggle, right?
They do. They had been ahead of all of the other sects in agitating to end slavery, but nobody had paid much attention to them in Britain because, you know, they said thee and thou, they dressed in a funny way with these big black hats, they wouldn't take off their hats except to preach or pray, so they were regarded as oddities. But Clarkson, who was an Anglican, realized that these were the folks who would be the ground troops of this movement. Mm. And that first committee that he brought together was 9 Quakers and 3 Anglicans. And it remained that kind of coalition for the whole duration of the movement. They pioneered all sorts of other things that we take for granted today. They created the first political poster. And we've all seen it. It's that top-down diagrammatic image of a slave ship that shows the slaves' bodies packed together like sardines in the hold. It's used today on book covers and record album covers and all sorts of things. They came up with the first logo ever designed for a political organization. It showed a kneeling slave in chains surrounded by the legend, "Am I not a man and a brother?" And when sometime later women got into the act, they came up with their logo that showed a woman slave in chains and the legend, "Am I not a woman and a sister?" They did the equivalent of getting their friends to write op-eds by having poet friends write anti-slavery ballads which could be sold on street corners. You know, these were some of the things that they did.
One piece I remember from the book very clearly, it involved the sugar boycotts as well, that individual people, and I think you say especially women, tended to decide that they would not eat any sugar, they would not buy any sugar. And I remember you mentioning one woman who basically spent about 50 years without having any sugar over the course of the entire movement until slavery was ended.
Actually, that was a guy, a friend of,
okay,
a friend of Clarkson's, who didn't resume eating sugar until Parliament had voted to free the slaves. But the consumer boycott, this was a powerful tool. This was the most widespread such boycott that had ever happened. And I think it was important also because not only did it show the power of such a tool, which we've used since then, but because it was women who bought the food for each household, it was women who were essentially organizing this boycott. and refusing to buy sugar when they weren't shopping.
Yeah. And it sounds like, coming back to something you mentioned before, it sounds like an interesting question, trying to weigh the cause of the end of slavery, how much of it came from the anti-slavery movement happening in England compared to what effect those revolts had in the Caribbean, the slave revolts. I'm sure in the end that they both played some kind of role.
They did. And a Jamaican-born friend of mine feels I didn't give enough time and space to the slave revolts in the book because they were really important. And they were important. Unfortunately, we don't have good documentation about what was going on the inside of those revolts, because one of the problems you find writing history is that, you know, the rich leave more records than the poor, the slave owners leave plenty of records, the slaves usually none at all, which is why having a book like Equiano's is so important.
Well, I will say that your section where you talk about the Haitian Revolution in your book is really one of the best concise descriptions of the Haitian Revolution I've ever read, because that's incredibly complicated. And you managed to condense it down, I don't know, to about 15, 20 pages or so of what happened and why it was so important, not only in Haiti itself, but to the abolition across the Atlantic.
I'm delighted to hear you say that, David, because it took me months to master all the intricacies of the Haitian Revolution, and I'm not sure I really did. It was an enormously complicated, faction-ridden, complex war, which kept changing the sides as kept changing as it went on. But it did sort of show that it was possible for a slave revolt to succeed. And I think the British from that point on were always thinking about, we better not let something like this get out of hand in one of our islands.
Yeah. So Adam, one of the things that strikes me about this story is I don't have any data on this, but I don't think that it is taught that often in schools, the anti-slavery movement. I actually looked at the New York State Standards today because I was curious, and it mentions briefly in one line the effect that the Enlightenment has on abolition and the roles of people like William Wilberforce, and that's what's in it. I happen to teach about it. I think it's an incredibly important story. Why do you think that this part of history has been so ignored and forgotten and unknown?
I think in this country anyway, it's because Americans like to think that they invented everything and that abolition came along first here, and we freed the slaves, and thanks to the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln and so on, ignoring the fact that the world's largest empire at that time, the British Empire, had, you know, freed their slaves some 25 years earlier. So I think it's largely sort of American chauvinism that has kept out of our school books the birth of this remarkable movement in England. In Britain, they do a little better, I think, because
that makes sense. That makes sense. And to close off here, what do you see as the big lesson, or what would you want most people to take away from this story?
I think it's a story about civil society at its best. It shows how, when you have functioning freedom of speech in a reasonably democratic country, a group of people who care passionately about something, you know, about human rights issue that has not yet been incorporated in their country's laws, can agitate successfully for it to be included. And I see it as, you know, that's the same lesson of the civil rights movement in this country. And it's interesting to see the exchanges between movements. You know, as I say, the British really got there first. But the Americans were acutely aware, American abolitionists were acutely aware of what was going on there. William Lloyd Garrison, you know, one of the leading crusaders here, went to London for some months in 1833 and sat in on the discussions among the British abolitionists as they were strategizing on how to get abolition through parliament. And some years later, he and Frederick Douglass, by all measures, the two leading abolitionists in the United States, were among the last people to visit Thomas Clarkson before he died. So, you know, these ideas and ways of doing things can cross national boundaries.
Well, Adam, you are an incredible writer. The way you tell this story is really powerful. You're not, you have a journalist background, not a historian background. Is that correct?
Right. I like to say I'm practicing history without a license because I never went to graduate school.
Well,
I think history belongs to all of us. It's too important to leave just to the accredited historians.
Well, historical memory really belongs to all of us, and it's something we can all contribute to. And I think there are certainly some journalists who write history where they just tell a story. And one of the things that sets you and someone I interviewed a couple weeks ago, Russell Shore, though, apart, is you write beautiful prose, but you also do deep research and you tell a real historical argument. And I think that's what makes some of the best and most accessible history books out there for the general public. So, Adam, are you working on something new? What's next in terms of books for you?
Actually, I just finished a book that came out in October called American Midnight, which is about the period of very harsh political repression in this country from 1917 to 1921. It's sort of the Trumpiest period of American history before Trump. And I think you'd find it interesting. American Midnight.
You wrote this book about 20 years ago, and this conversation was still chock full of detail about this history, which is really impressive. So, Adam, what are two other books you could recommend about this or any other topic related to Bury the Chains?
Two I would recommend. One would be Equiano's autobiography. Its full official title is The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Olaudah Equiano. It has been somewhat rediscovered in recent decades. There are several different editions of it. And I think it's an immensely valuable story because it is really the first full life description we have of what it was like to be a British slave in that era. The other book I would recommend is something called Disposable People by Kevin Bales, which is about modern day slavery, because people shouldn't assume that the abolitionists completely solved the problem. There are tens of millions of people in the world today who are in effect slaves because, you know, they're contract agricultural workers whose employers have seized their passports and they can't leave the plantations where they work. They're sex slaves who were coerced into brothels. They're, you know, producing a lot of the chocolate that we consume that comes from Africa in many different parts of the world. And Kevin Bales is a real expert on this, writes well, and I recommend his book, Disposable People.
And Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times has written over the years a number of really important pieces about sex slavery and human trafficking all across the world.
Absolutely. A wonderfully good writer whose heart is so much in the right place.
Yeah. Well, Adam, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David. It was a pleasure. And it always gives me joy to see a teacher who's interested in these issues. And you teach in a public high school? Or
I teach public high school in Westchester, Scarsdale High School. Yes. And I think that, as you said, there's just a really important lesson from this movement. Not only is the history itself important, but this is one of the cases where we can take some really crucial lessons about life, about empathy, about compassion. So I think you bringing this story to life, it's definitely one that should continue to be heard.
Great. OK. Okay, well, good luck to you, and I hope you keep on using the book with your students.
Thank you to my guest and also to Colin McGrath for the beautiful background music. You can check out all of Colin's music, including his amazing album Window Seat, on Spotify. You can also take a look at my books, upcoming picture books, materials for teachers, and writings on authentic assessment and other topics in social studies like role plays and mock trials at davidsharon.com. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you come on back.